Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Schmidt, Judge Reyes, Judge Cochran, the Honorable John Schmidt presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is June 5th. We have four cases on our calendar today. Three of those cases for oral argument. I think you're all familiar with the procedures here. The podium does adjust, so feel free to adjust the podium to fit your height. Appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your opening, 5 minutes for rebuttal. Respondent, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument. When you're ready, please state your name for the record and who you represent. And counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Claire Glenn, and I represent Mylene Villard. During the summer of 2021, Enbridge was constructing a Line 3 fossil fuel pipeline across northern Minnesota, and Anishinaabe water protectors were organized in a movement to protest the harms of that construction and the legal violations that Enbridge was committing. As part of this movement, Ms. Villard climbed into a bamboo structure over the driveway of a fossil fuel pump station. Doing so was an act of peaceful protest. Ms. Villard climbed in long before law enforcement arrived, and while law enforcement witnesses gave conflicting and incomplete testimony about the details of her arrest, there is no doubt that she was passively arrested without the use of any force, and at no point was she ever aggressive, violent, or threatening. The state, in response, charged her with the highest level enhancement for obstruction, making it a felony. The trial that followed should have been a fair evaluation of her conduct and the law. Instead, it was marred by pervasive prosecutorial misconduct, including several instances which are now conceded by the state. That's in addition to the broadcasting of trial proceedings, which we know occurred at least during the third day of trial, the day when three of the state's witnesses were testifying and all four witnesses were present in the courthouse hallways.
But the jurors were questioned about that, correct?
That's correct.
And all of them agreed that they did not hear any of that broadcasting.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I'm curious as to what the harm is then, because from that, if none of the jurors were tainted by that.
Right, and that's why we've focused the harm on the sequestration of witnesses, because the third day of trial was the day that all of the state's witnesses were on call and were waiting in the public hallways to testify as the trial proceedings, including arguments where no witness was supposed to be present, and including the testimony of other witnesses, was being overheard. One thing that I think is particularly notable, the cases that the state has cited all involve much more discrete sequestration issues. What happened here was a whole-scale violation of the court's sequestration order, in which it's quite reasonable to assume that one or more witnesses was able to hear the testimony of other witnesses, was able to hear the arguments of counsel. I would also note that I think it's quite, first, I would note that since the issue is a due process violation.
Right, and that's why I'm a little confused. I mean, it seems like you're conflating the sequestration issue with the due process issue.
Well, the sequestration issue was one of a magnitude that I don't think this court has ever seen before. And in response, the trial judge buried his head in the sand and did not want to inquire at all as to what had occurred.
Well, now there was an inquiry that was made. It was just made by the state, correct?
No, that's not correct.
In terms of what had happened with respect to the jurors and what they had heard.
So the court asked the jurors if they had heard anything. They indicated that they did not. Both the prosecutor and defense counsel were asking for an opportunity to voir dire the deputy who had done the broadcast himself, which potentially could have revealed inconsistencies with what the jurors had said. I don't know. But what we were denied an opportunity to inquire at all about was whether Officer Bolt heard Officer Cook's testimony, Sergeant Payment heard Officer Cook's testimony, Officer Bolt heard Sergeant Payment's testimony, Sheriff Guida heard everyone's testimony.
So and didn't the district court suggest that that could be asked of the witnesses when they were testifying?
Well,
the law enforcement witnesses?
The sequestration violation only came to light after three of the four witnesses had testified.
Okay. So, but with the one witness that hadn't testified, was there any questioning of that witness when the witness was on the stand as to whether that witness heard anything of the live streaming?
There was not. And
that's what I thought. So then how is there prejudice here if there wasn't any questioning at that point?
Well, the due process analysis looks at the risk of harm involved and what process should be due as a result. The risk of harm is great. There's a reason that sequestration orders are routinely granted. And the process that was given was almost nothing. Ms. Villard was entitled to a voir dire of Sheriff Guida outside the presence of the jury, not having to choose between does she ask a question that she doesn't know the answer to and risk infecting the jury with information that is not admissible, that the jury should not be hearing, or does she not ask the question and be in this situation? What was due to her, the process that was due to her, was the very reasonable and available process to the trial court, which was to have a voir dire outside the presence of the jury, which is what both parties were asking for.
If you're done addressing that issue, I'd like to turn to the question of prosecutorial misconduct.
Absolutely.
One of the main issues in your brief, the state concedes five instances of prosecutorial misconduct. Based on your review of the record, do you agree that those were all objected to? It seems that the state is suggesting that they were all objected to.
Yes, we would agree.
And so in terms of applying the harmless error approach to all five, what would be your argument in terms of whether each instance was serious or less serious, and do we view them individually or collectively in making that analysis?
Yes, the Mayhorn case, I think, makes clear that what's at issue is the cumulative impact of prosecutorial misconduct. So we certainly think that this court should view the misconduct, and to be clear, we are not suggesting that the misconduct is limited to those instances.
No, I understand that. I just want to initially focus on the first five that are conceded.
Absolutely.
And whether those by themselves meet the standard to show that the error was not harmless.
Yes, and I think it does. Or
that the misconduct, you know, was not harmless.
All five of the conceded misconduct fall into the general category of what I think the prosecutor was trying to do with his misconduct, which is to unfairly bolster and vouch for law enforcement while insinuating to the jury that Ms. Villard was not credible and that she was to blame for this mysterious evidence that was better that was never presented to them. This is particularly prejudicial in a case that was essentially a battle of credibility. Law enforcement, you know, there wasn't really clear body camera that we have. The officers that were up in the bucket truck, Officer Bolt and Sheriff Guida, did not have body camera on. And
there is one video that I saw that showed the bucket truck going up and shows appellant, placing her arm in the device. That seems pretty clear, but I agree with you that part is maybe the only part that's clear.
And Ms. Villard testified that locking down to that device was a pre-planned activity that was not a response to law enforcement. I understand that the jury did not end
that's
up...
Her, but that's her testimony, though. On appeal, we look have to look at the evidence in light most favorable to the jury's verdict. So when we don't consider that in terms of our review.
When we're talking about sufficiency of the evidence, that's correct.
Still,
but
right.
We're talking about the prejudicial impact of the prosecutor's misconduct. And the prejudicial impact of the prosecutor's misconduct is that he continued to bolster the credibility of law enforcement and undermine the credibility of Ms. Villard in these very clearly impermissible ways, ways that are conceded by the state. And so it's important to look at the ways in which Ms. Villard did offer evidence to the contrary about what her specific intent was, and it was not found.
What case law supports that approach, though? That seems contrary to basic our standard of review, even with respect to prosecutorial misconduct.
I would disagree. I think the court is correct that under the sufficiency of the evidence standard, we take the facts in the light most favorable to the verdict.
I'm not talking about the circumstantial evidence, and I realize that that's a separate argument.
Mm-hmm.
But on review from a jury verdict, we view the evidence in light most favorable to that verdict.
Not when there's conceded misconduct and the court's inquiry is what impact did that misconduct have. If the question is what...
But isn't the focus there then on what the state did rather than what somebody testified to?
I think it's important for this court to look at all of the evidence, including evidence that clearly the jury did not find credible, and to look at if there's a nexus between the misconduct that the prosecutor was engaging in and the evidence that the jury discredited. Because if the reason the jury discredited, or there's a conceivable possibility, a reasonable possibility, that the reason the jury found that evidence not credible is because of the misconduct, then that misconduct certainly cannot be harmless. And that's essentially the state's argument. The state is...
What case do you think stands for that proposition that we look at the nexus between the misconduct of the prosecutor and the evidence that the jury discredited?
I guess I don't have a case at the tip of my tongue, and I can try to look at that briefly and get that to the court, because it's just sort of the logical obviousness of what the harmless error review is. I think when we look at what do
well,
courts...
Well, I think our Supreme Court has stated, you know, the standard for the harmless error review. So if you could tie your argument to that standard articulated by our Supreme Court, which is looking at the strength of the state's evidence, the pervasiveness of the misconduct, which you've addressed, and whether the defendant had an opportunity to rebut the evidence. If you can point us to another case that goes more to this precise argument on rebuttal, we would appreciate hearing that. But I think
that's the
usual standard that's applied.
And
I
will try to get that to the court. I don't have a case name at the tip of my tongue, but I do recall cases in which the strength of the defense's case was also considered in the question of whether or not the misconduct was prejudicial.
So what is your, setting aside the evidence that the jury discredited, looking at the state's evidence and the pervasiveness of the misconduct and whether there was an opportunity to rebut the misconduct, what is your best argument that the conceded instances did not result in harmless error?
Well,
and then you can add in the other instances if you like, but I'd like to focus on those five first.
Sure, Your Honor. So I think that the state's case is not a strong one, but particularly looking at the lack of an opportunity to rebut Ms. Villard, the misconduct built on itself. And I think probably the culmination of the prosecutor's misconduct was what he stated in rebuttal, telling the jurors that they should be considering not the evidence before them, but what was not introduced in evidence, that they should be speculating about what was not introduced. And that followed after all of the prosecutor's attempts to introduce inadmissible evidence and, you know, the cuts and scratches against Sergeant Payment.
But on the, if you're focusing on the argument, opportunity to rebut, defendant did have an opportunity to rebut those, and in fact, did raise objections, and most, if not all, of those objections were sustained by the district court. In fact, the district court provided curative instructions for a number of them, and we have to assume on appeal that the jury followed those instructions.
Well, I actually don't think that that's necessarily true, and I would direct the court's attention to Streeter.
What's not necessarily true?
If I may explain. So if I could direct the court's attention to the Streeter case, in that case, and I'm going to have to paraphrase the exact quote, but this court found that the only reason it could surmise that the prosecutor continued to engage in misconduct after sustained objections, after admonishments by the court, after curative instructions, was his belief that it was nonetheless effective. The fact that the prosecutor continued to engage in this shows that it was prejudicial, because if it was not worth it to the prosecutor, he would have abided by the court's admonishments and instructions. Instead, the prosecutor continued to capitalize on his misconduct. And I would also note that there's a Hobson's choice when you're being repeatedly forced to object in front of a jury. You're put as a defense, as a defendant, in a position where you either fail to object to what is clearly objectionable and not preserve it, or repeatedly be forced to look in front of the jury like you're objecting, like you're trying to hide something from the jury. And the prosecutor capitalized on that and basically told the jury, Ms. Villard is hiding things from you, and you should hold it against her. I see my time is up.
Yes, counsel, your time is up. I have one more question for you, though.
Sure.
Just briefly, we've got the five conceded that we've been discussing. What are your best other, you know, two or three other non-objected to, not conceded instances?
Yes. I would note the impeaching Ms. Villard directly with her exercise of her trial rights to be present, to have counsel, trying to impeach her and discredit her with remaining silent, both at trial, the fact that she the prosecutor basically forecasted to the jury that she could and should testify in her defense. There were other instances of bolstering that we detailed in our brief that I think the state sort of glossed over in not admitting to. I mean, I've got a list of 13, but I think for the sake of time, I will rest on the briefing.
Yeah, that's perfect. I know you have many others, but I just wanted, before you sat down, I wanted to have you a chance to get out your best couple in case we have questions for that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
And you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you.
And then counsel for respondent, when you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning on behalf of Respondent, the State of Minnesota. We have conceded several instances of misconduct in this case, and the resolution of those issues will essentially come down to a prejudicial impact analysis, I think, as the argument this morning is previewed. I'm more than happy to answer questions about that prejudicial impact analysis, but I wanted to start with two of the sufficiency issues. And I wanted to start there because, just as a reminder to the court, because of some tricky double jeopardy issues, even if the court were to ultimately reverse on misconduct grounds, it still does need to address the sufficiency issues in the ultimate opinion. And specifically, the issues I want to begin with have to do with the disputed intent element, as well as whether there was sufficient evidence of whether Ms. Villard's conduct was obstructive. So on the intent element, obstruction is a general intent crime. The relevant statute, section 609.50, requires that the defendant intentionally obstruct a peace officer. And in Fleck, the Minnesota Supreme Court said, quote, when a statute simply prohibits a person from intentionally engaging in the prohibited conduct, the crime is a general intent crime. So this court is bound by that rule, and that makes this an easy issue. Obstruction is a general intent offense because the statute uses the word intentionally rather than with intent to. Now, appellant has two main responses to that argument. The first is that appellant just tries to ignore or distort the Fleck opinion. On page 11 of the reply brief, appellant says that the word intentionally in criminal statutes evinces, quote, a mens rea requirement equivalent to or greater than that evinced by the words with intent to. That's just completely irreconcilable with what the Supreme Court said in Fleck. So I think we can put that argument to the side. The second argument that appellant makes is essentially a constitutional avoidance argument, namely that adopting a general intent rule for this statute would create a First Amendment overbreadth problem. Specifically under State versus Krosky. But that is wrong also. In Krosky, the Supreme Court said that, quote, an intent element is necessary to avoid facial overbreadth. General intent is an intent element. The Minnesota Supreme Court has been quite clear that general intent is not strict liability and that it is an intent element.
The district court instructed on specific intent, though, right?
Correct, Your Honor, but I'm talking about sufficiency of the evidence. And we have a footnote in our brief explaining that what the district court instructed is not really relevant to the determination of sufficiency because we look at the elements of the crime, not how the jury was instructed about the elements.
Well, that's based on the Masciato Supreme Court opinion, which hasn't been expressly adopted yet in Minnesota.
Has not been adopted in a precedential opinion, but this court has a long line of non-precedential cases applying it. But beside the non-precedential authority, if you just think about the distinction between a jury instruction problem and a sufficiency problem, there's an important distinction there. That distinction has to do with the consequences of a finding of sufficiency. If the evidence is sufficient, if the state doesn't meet the statutory elements, there is a double jeopardy bar against re-prosecution. If the problem has to do with the instructions, that's a different question. Instructions don't meet up with the evidence or the instructions don't meet up with the state's theory, there can be a retrial.
But if the Supreme Court, let's say our Supreme Court doesn't adopt Masciato, if they don't, then it's a law of the case analysis, in which case we are looking at specific intent for this evidence because that's what the jury was told.
I don't agree that it's a law of the case analysis. The state's position is that you look at the elements of the offense when dealing with sufficiency.
No, I understand. I'm just saying the Washington state rejected the Masciato analysis for their state, and if our Supreme Court were to do the same, then we're under a law of the case analysis because Masciato doesn't apply, and we're looking at sufficiency as specific intent.
Sure, I would agree if there was precedent rejecting what I've said about the distinction between sufficiency and jury instructions, then the jury instructions would control on appeal. But that just goes to just a rejection of my argument.
So I have a question about the intent argument and how to interpret the statute. Our court has said that the language in the statute 609.50 applies to conduct directed at a police officer. I know you have an argument in your brief trying to parse that out, but that language seems pretty clear to me. So doesn't that require that there be specific intent?
I don't see the language directed at as implying a specific intent. I view that as the nature of the conduct. You know, that case, State versus Morin, honestly,
even if we assume sorry, go ahead.
No, so what I was going to say is as I said in the brief, in a footnote, we do think Morin was wrongly decided. It's a precedent from this court. We do think it should be overruled. But even applying the rule from Morin, conduct directed at the officer, if you look at the conduct at issue in this case, there's not a reasonable way to conclude that the conduct was not directed at the officers. So specifically,
even if we assume specific intent applies, is the evidence sufficient?
Yes, and in addition, so the more I view as going to whether the conduct was obstructive,
okay.
And then on specific intent, I view that as a different element and a different issue. But for both, if appellants rule on both of those elements are correct, we satisfy both. So I think the conduct in terms of the Morin issue, in terms of Ms. Villard affixing her arm to the Sleeping Dragon device, not until the officers were ascending in the bucket truck, that shows pretty clearly that conduct is directed at them and their intent to arrest Ms. Villard. So I think that conduct is directed at those officers. In terms of specific intent, I'm going to look to the same evidence. The fact that she did that not until they were ascending in the bucket truck, I think shows that her intent in doing so was to make it more difficult to extract her from the structure and to arrest her. So the court really doesn't need to reach sort of the statutory interpretation arguments or the arguments about Morin because we think that the evidence is sufficient on both those elements, even under appellant's own rules. The other point I wanted to make on the intent element is that even if you disagree with me about simple obstruction is a general intent crime, we have the problem of the fact that Ms. Villard was not charged with simple obstruction. Ms. Villard was charged with felony obstruction, and felony obstruction adds a mens rea element. The defendant has to know or have reason to know that their conduct created a risk of death or substantial bodily harm. So that additional element to the charge that Ms. Villard was found guilty of committing should displace any facial overbreadth problems. So you can save these constitutional overbreadth questions for a case involving simple obstruction. The fact that this is a felony obstruction conviction sort of takes us out of the world of any concern of facial overbreadth in terms of the First Amendment.
So how is the evidence sufficient to show that she knew or had reason to know that the act created a risk of death, substantial bodily harm, or serious property damage?
So if you just look at the overall circumstances of what happened and what Ms. Villard did, they were perched 15 to 20 feet in the air. Ms. Villard was an experienced climber. She took several safety precautions leading up to the demonstration. And all of that suggests that she is somebody who would know that if you're engaging in this activity of affixing yourself to this pipe at 20 feet, that there is some risk of harm. That is why you wear a helmet. That is why you take safety precautions going into
of
the
harm to who?
To anyone is the relevant statutory requirement.
But who specifically in this situation?
Well, if you put on a helmet, I think you're talking about harm to yourself. Presumably Ms. Villard also has a concern for her companion who's in the structure. That's why she testified. That's why she was selected to participate, because she was the person who was experienced in climbing.
Say then that anytime someone goes rock climbing, there's a risk of substantial bodily harm?
I think a jury could reasonably conclude that, Your Honor. Yes.
That's
why.
Does the fact that she put her arm in the device factor into the analysis?
That's the obstructive conduct. So your conduct.
Does that go to the risk of harm?
It does, because it makes it more difficult to arrest you at that height and to extract you from the structure. That's the purpose in doing so. That act has to be, under the statute, has to be the thing that creates the risk of harm. And so there was already a risk of harm in doing this, and then that risk of harm was exacerbated by the obstructive act of Ms. Villard affixing herself to the Sleeping Dragon.
If I could, you know, your time's running short, and I'd like to get to the prosecutorial misconduct argument. So you have five conceded issues. Can you, as we were discussing that before, how do we view the evidence within the prejudice standard? We're looking at the strength of the state's case. Do we have to defer to the verdicts at the same time within that?
Your Honor, I guess I'll cite to a case that wasn't mentioned in the briefs, but I just know it offhand, and I'm sure the court is aware of it, State versus Big Bear. It's not a misconduct case, but it is about a prejudicial impact analysis. And what the Supreme Court said in Big Bear is that you look exclusively at the state's evidence of guilt. So that issue, I think, was settled by Big Bear. I don't think there's any reason to say that we would conduct a prejudice inquiry different in the misconduct analysis than we would for an evidentiary error or some other type of error. Usually the analyses look somewhat similar. I know there are cases that highlight particular factors for particular types of errors, but I do think it's a general inquiry that looks at all the circumstances, and Big Bear says you look exclusively at the state's evidence when assessing like how strong was the state's case. And that's really our argument on prejudice in this case. Not just that this was a really strong case against Ms. Villard, but also that the facts of the case were largely undisputed, aside from Ms. Villard's intent, that there was really no dispute about what happened. This was such a straightforward case, and what Ms. Villard did was so obviously obstructive in nature that regardless of what the prosecutor did, I don't think a reasonable jury would have found Ms. Villard to be not guilty.
Counsel, first of all, let me just say I really appreciate your candor in terms of the admission of the five types of prosecutorial misconduct here. So I just want to acknowledge that.
Certainly
first
are.
And foremost. That being said, looking at the cumulative effect of these, and they weren't just isolated with one particular witness or in one particular part of the trial. They occurred throughout the trial and even in closing argument, including the five that were admitted to. Why isn't that cumulative impact enough to overcome the standard, looking at the three factors that we have to consider, the strength of the case, and in particular, when the defense is being put in a position where they have to object over and over and over, which can create an impression with a jury that they're trying to hide something here because they keep objecting over and over and over. Why isn't that enough to meet the harmless error standard?
So, Your Honor, I think one thing I would say is just to reference what I just said, is that we do think that, at least for those five, that this case was so straightforward, such an obvious instance of obstruction, that just the nature of those five instances, I just don't think it's reasonable to conclude that the jury would have reached a different verdict. The other thing I would say, as counsel said this morning, is I think appellant's theory is that a lot of these errors sort of fall in a single bucket, which has to do with vouching and bolstering. And so if that's true, if the errors are sort of like of a certain type, then I think that lessens the prejudicial impact of the errors, because it's not as if, again, if we're talking about these five, it's not as if there's X, Y, Z, A, B, different rights being affected throughout the trial by the misconduct. It really goes to one thing.
Right, but it goes to kind of the heart of the case in terms of credibility, particularly when it wasn't really clear as to what officer said what, or when the appellant thought that they were under arrest. And so there seemed to be a little bit of confusion there and inconsistency in the state's testimony. And so why would the state need to go so far? Why would the prosecutor need to go so far to try to continue to bolster the witnesses unless those inconsistencies, would have impacted the trial?
Certainly, Your Honor. And Judge Schmidt, I'm out of time.
May I
respond? So first thing, the prosecutor didn't need to. That's why we've conceded error. And I do want to be candid about that. But the second point I guess I would make in response to that is this depiction of the case as a battle of credibility between law enforcement and Ms. Villard, I just disagree with that view of the case. And again, I'm going to go back to my basic theme, is that this was so obviously a case of obstruction. The claim that Ms. Villard had no reason to know that there was a risk of danger by doing this at this height, or the claim that there was no intent to obstruct by affixing herself to this device when the police were ascending in the bucket truck to arrest her, it's just on its face so not credible that I don't think we should be viewing this case as just a simple dispute about credibility. That is just not how I view the case, and I don't think that's a reasonable view of the case. So that would be my response. This is not one of those close cases where it really is, the jury is left with a really difficult credibility determination. That's just not the nature of this case.
And Judge Cochran has another question for you, and then I might do.
So I also appreciate the state's candor in terms of at least those five instances constituting prosecutorial misconduct. But in analyzing whether those instances were prejudicial or whether it was harmless error, your brief seems to look at each one individually. Would you agree with that? Or I guess what I'm trying to get at is, do you think the case law supports looking at them individually or cumulatively in analyzing whether they were less or more serious under the two-tiered harmless error approach, which I know has been called into question but not overruled?
Yeah, so I guess I'm going to come at that from two directions, or maybe come at that question from two levels, because on the question of just determining whether the once you've found misconduct, let's just assume we're dealing with these five, which ones were serious and which weren't. I have never found anything in the case law that provides any guidance about how to determine whether something was serious or not serious misconduct. Just to be honest with you, I've never seen a case explain that. We don't think that these were serious. I do agree with Ms. Glenn that in the prejudicial impact analysis, you look at the collective effect of all the instances of misconduct.
But I guess what I'm getting at is, in determining which of the two-tiered approaches to apply, do we look at all five together to determine whether it was less or more serious prejudicial misconduct?
I guess what I would say is I don't have a case, and I've never seen one that answers that question. If the court thinks that the proper approach is to say, look at all of these, we're not going to isolate them from each other. We're going to say in their collection this was serious. I think that's a reasonable way to do the analysis. I disagree in this case, but I don't see anything to say that was wrong.
Even all five together are less serious.
They would fall
into that category.
That's the state's position, and we've cited a couple cases in a footnote for why we think that's the case.
And I have a question on that less serious piece, because I'm really concerned about two of the conceded prosecutorial misconduct pieces, both of which gave inferences about evidence that was not in the record, and told the jury in closing to draw reasonable inferences off of what's not in the record, so expressly did that, and then also talked about this body cam that was never introduced. Those seem pretty serious to me.
Your Honor, I said for both of those in the brief that there's no defense for those comments for a reason that never should have been said, and it should never be said in a trial. I think if you look at the cases that we cite in our brief, if I could find the footnote, State versus Her from this court, where the prosecutor said, this is not the defendant's country. This is our country. And this court said that that's not
that
as serious.
That was in isolation.
Correct, Your Honor. But that is also significantly egregious. And I don't think that what happened here compares to that. There is a distinction there. So I certainly understand where these comments are coming from. There is a reason why we conceded what we did and why we said what we said about the misconduct that we think did occur. But we just think that this case was so straightforward and that this is such an obvious instance of obstruction that the court can feel confident that Ms. Villard was guilty and can affirm the conviction. And we ask the court to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I need to adjust this table.
And take your time.
Thank you. Even shorter than I realized. I want to start by just noting, Judge Schmidt, you noted the examples where the prosecutor had indicated that there was better evidence out there. There's another example where the prosecutor, in trying to elicit testimony about other protesters that were on the roadway, in explaining why he was trying to elicit testimony that had been explicitly excluded by the court, he said that he was bringing that up because there were other pictures not introduced that had a better angle. So I did just want to note that. I also want to address what I think is related to the prejudice analysis here, which is the state's claim that obstruction is a general intent crime. It is not at all foreclosed by Fleck. In fact, a close reading of Fleck indicates that Fleck involved an entirely different definitional section of the Minnesota criminal statutes. And Fleck itself explains that the ultimate fidelity should be to the statutory definition. And it is the statutory definition of intentionally that makes clear specific, that obstruction is a specific intent offense. And that's why the criminal jury instruction guide, for example, refers to obstruction as a specific intent offense. We did brief that in our reply brief, so I would just, if the court has no particular questions about that, I would just reference that. I would also note that this direct effects test that the state is advancing, you would not need to only overrule Morin, you would also need to overrule Patch in order to completely rework what is required in order to prove obstruction. The direct effects test was explicitly rejected in Patch. The test is directed at law enforcement. I think it's probably analogous to think about assault. When we look at the other cases involving conduct that has been found to be sufficient to justify an obstruction conviction, those have all involved some sort of assaultive conduct, right?
Why do we need to go that far, though? Because the case that that discussed fleeing is not enough to show conduct directed at a peace officer. But why isn't the conduct of as soon as she saw the police officers approaching her that she put the sleeping dragon on, why isn't that enough to show that it is directed at the police officers to prevent them from arresting her?
A few different reasons. First, I think that if we're looking at fleeing as not being directed at law enforcement, it's almost directed away from law enforcement. I think that locking down to a sleeping dragon is similarly directed away from law enforcement, if anything.
Well, it seems like it's an act directed at police officers to prevent to resist arrest. It seems to be different than just fleeing.
Sure,
to that argument, and this might be part of your argument, but it seems like her, potentially climbing up further seems like fleeing, which may not meet the definition of being directed at, but putting the harness on does seem to be more directed at the police officers. Why isn't that so?
Right. So I would note putting on a sleeping dragon and just staying where you are, it might make law enforcement's job a little bit harder, but you're not fighting with law enforcement. You're not directing that at law enforcement. You're also not, in a way, fleeing is more culpable conduct because you might actually escape and evade law enforcement if you're fleeing. If you're simply locked down to a device where you're passively seated, it might make it a bit more annoying to arrest you. It might take a little bit more time.
So let's assume just a hypothetical. I'm usually not big on hypotheticals, but one popped into my head. Let's assume you get stopped for fleeing an officer in a car, and the police go to and tell you to come out so that they can arrest you. Instead, you handcuff yourself to the steering wheel. Would that be an action directed at the police officers to prevent them from arresting you?
I don't think that it would be sufficiently directed at to justify an obstruction charge. There might be other charges, but we know obstructing in particular involves directed at in a way that's more aligned with assaultive conduct. I would also note that I think this dovetails with the specific intent element because Ms. Villard is not someone who is simply fleeing from law enforcement, right? There might be an argument in that case that there is specific intent to direct that handcuffing in a way that is directed at law enforcement. That might be a distinction from this case. But here, there's very clear evidence that her protest conduct was entirely directed at Enbridge and had nothing to do with law enforcement. There was no, you know...
Well, in terms of a sufficiency argument, though, we assume that the jury in convicting didn't believe that evidence or that testimony.
But that then...
I think you even concede that in your brief.
We do. We do. But under the circumstantial evidence test, the first step is to look at... And I see my time is up if I may answer the question. Under the circumstantial evidence test, the first step is to identify the facts that were established.
Right.
But the second step is to examine those facts and see if there's a reasonable inference other than guilt. Here, there is a reasonable inference other than guilt, and it's that Ms. Villard had no intent to obstruct law enforcement.
But that
depends on the testimony that isn't a circumstance that's rejected, so it's not a circumstance proved.
Her testimony is not a circumstance proved, but the fact that the banner said stop line 3 and resistance is love, the fact that the Sleeping Dragon itself said land back, indigenous sovereignty.
I understand.
There was never a, you know, like for lack of a better word, like F the police, right? That was never a part of this protest. I think a similar way to explain this is, did people who were seated at lunch counters who had to be arrested because they refused to leave, were they intending to obstruct law enforcement? Were people who refused to get off a bus, were they intending to obstruct law enforcement? I don't think so. I think, like those individuals, Ms. Villard was hoping that law enforcement would show up and recognize that the real harm was being committed by Enbridge. That's in the record, right? The harms that Ms. Villard was protesting did occur. Enbridge was violating the law. And I think it says a lot about our criminal system that the state is sort of assuming law enforcement shows up and arrests the individual protester and does nothing to interrogate her claims that this corporation is violating the law. I think it's reasonable, perhaps naive, but reasonable and something that, you know, idealism we should all strive for, that she was hoping law enforcement would do something different.
I have one final question for you, which is to go back to what we were talking about in your opening on the prejudice standard for the misconduct. Did you find, counsel cited Big Bear, did you find a case as you were, I know it's tough, I've been there, but as your opposing counsel was talking?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I was not able to, but
okay.
Particularly given the citation to Big Bear, if I may even have 24 hours, and if I do find a case, just to submit that in a letter to the court.
The rules certainly provide for supplemental authority and provide for a response, so you can certainly follow the rules and submit a supplemental authority letter.
Thank you. I will do that. I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today. The case is submitted. And we will get an opinion out within the statutory time frame.